You're listening to episode 25 of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet or you're listening on iTunes or Podiobooks.com, you can stop by The Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. Or you can email me directly at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter, username TheGearheart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of the Gearheart. Last time on the Gearheart, Keegan and Augustus were confronted with the decision of whether or not to follow the Council's will. When they chose to go rogue, Keegan mounted a daring rescue of Agent Maeve Manners from the special agents guarding her. However, Jonathan still finds himself trapped in Isabel's room with three queensmen. Will he survive? Find out on the Gearheart. With their pronouncements made, the three queensmen cast spells like an engine with the throttle thrown wide, their multicolored glyphs ripping the air open. Jonathan leapt clear as he felt the space fold around the spot where he was just standing and shatter apart. Some invisible force caught purchase around Jonathan's torso, however, and it hefted him a few feet upward before he could reorient himself. Without warning, Jonathan found himself falling backwards, as if gravity had quite suddenly changed directions. As Jonathan's back met the wall, he felt the raw power of the Queensman's spell press against him with a force that he had never felt before. In addition to the blow dealt to the initiate by his own inertia, a second force bore down upon his chest like a hydraulic press. First, the air fled Jonathan's lungs with an involuntary shout, but then the real pain began. In the sides of Jonathan's chest, he could feel his ribs straining against the oncoming destruction of the Queensman's glyph. Jonathan looked into the eyes of the lead queensman, who held his hand toward him, fingers extended in a claw-like fashion, and Jonathan saw murder in the man's heart. The initiate's gaze drifted to Isabel's silent face, and he tried to summon the courage to die without fear. He tried to take a breath, but it was no use. The air would not come. Then brilliant pain like pure sunlight rushed into his lungs as one of his ribs cracked. His eyes echoed the quiet scream his lips could not issue. Jonathan fell limp, but the pain continued to barrel through him like a wild animal. Colors danced before the initiate's eyes as he felt his internal organs subjected to feelings unimaginable to him before. The Queensmen would squash Jonathan like an insect soon, and they would go on with their daily lives. Jonathan took sudden solace in the fact that, when he died, his revenge would eventually reach the Queensmen when the world ended. The scene grew very dim, and the pain became a fuzzy prickle spread over the corpus of the initiate. Jonathan's eyes rolled back in his head, and his brain refused to listen to him. And still, the horror that issued from his ribs was like an exploding star in his mind. Soon, though, Jonathan knew that all of this would no longer concern him. Somehow, the tiniest bit of air climbed into his nose and registered something new. Smoke. Then came the screams. The Queensman's glyph was suddenly broken, and Jonathan plummeted to the floor on the far side of the room. Burning blood seemed to ricochet through his lungs, and the initiate's throat forced out a gurgling scream from between cracked lips. He wanted to clutch his sides in pain, but he was so far beyond that mindset that he was scared to even touch his torso. Through his tightly closed eyes, there was no way that he could know the source of the screams. He managed to creak one eye open, and was greeted with a flailing conflagration of a man, flanked on both sides by shocked queensmen. Somehow, their leader had combusted, and he seemed intent on taking much of the room with him. The lights in the ceiling and in the hallway had gone out, but the exterior windows of the room and the flaming Queensman provided plenty of illumination. The fiery man was transformed instantly from a dignified officer to an animal, hungrily searching for an instrument of his own survival. In his panicked state, the lead Queensman dashed straight for Jonathan's fallen body, and the initiate tensed. The sheer potency of Jonathan's agony, however, told him that he would not be moving, as the initiate attempted to claw his way along the floor to get out of the Queensman's path. Jonathan mustered everything he could and pulled his legs up under him to lash out at the oncoming Queensman, feeling his body complain with every pain nerve it could find. As the Queensman came within feet of the initiate, Jonathan felt the air grow charged with the flames of the man's burning flesh. When the scorched whites of the Queensman's eyes were visible, the flames suddenly surged and flashed. White light spilled into the room like burning magnesium, as Jonathan's attacker instantaneously vaporized with a deafening thunderclap. When Jonathan could see again, black soot slithered across the floor, settling on his skin and clothes, and there's no sign of the flaming man who was present just seconds before. The other two Queensmen looked on in horror at some new threat that emerged from the bedside of the room. Isabel Carriker was sitting up in bed. Agent Darren Freeman, by the order of the Council of the Seekers of the Arcane Unknown, you are under arrest for the crimes of high treason and conspiracy, came the voice. Dead or alive, you're coming with me. Darren turned around and saw the Queensman standing in the middle of the hallway, his sidearm drawn and pointed between the agent's eyes. The man's face had a mechanical cause-and-effect look about it. If Darren turned to bolt, the Queensman would automatically pull the trigger without even a second thought. Darren raised his hands, but this wouldn't do. He needed to get back to Cog before Jonathan ruined everything. There just wasn't time to be arrested. "I prefer alive, if you please," said Darren, raising his hands. "A wise decision," said the Queensman, approaching Darren with a pair of interlocking gauntlets with bound fingers. "Lock your fingers above your head. If I see any magic out of you, I'll..." Then there was a distant roar of flames, and all of the lights went out. Darren's practiced hands acted before he could even consider his actions. His delicate fingers etched a precise green glyph in the air, and he lashed out the Queensman's neck with his free hand. As Darren's skin made contact with the Queensman's, a crashing wave of euphoria swept through the bearded agent's lanky body, and Darren's assailant went completely limp. Shafts of sunlight pierced the hallway through some of the doors to rooms with windows. In the dim, dusty light, Darren could see the eyes of his victim as he tried to access his extremities. The agent held the Queensman, one-handed, by his neck, and Darren caught the victim's collar as the man started to fall. The medic gently placed the Queensman onto the ground and leaned close to whisper into the man's ear. "My friend," said Darren, "I just want you to know that you were unfortunate to be tasked with capturing me." The Queensman tried to shake Darren off of him, but to no avail. Darren brushed away the man's hands as if they were a newborn baby's. "They probably told you that I was the medic," said Darren, "and that I was the smallest threat, but I have been around long enough to know how to handle your type. You see, what so few people realize is that the conduit of life flows two ways." Tiny tufts of white hair snaked across the Queensman's scalp, and his lips began to shrivel and crack. Darren unbuttoned to the top button of the Queensman's collar and ripped the man's shirt open down to his chest. The agent felt his victim's heartbeat almost pound out of his ribcage as Darren placed an open palm on the fellow's sternum. "I can give things to you, or you can give things to me." And with that, Darren threw open the floodgates to the reserves of magic inside him, and the Queensman's precious life poured into him like a river. Darren's vision blurred, and his heart began to race faster and faster, and it felt as though his chest would explode. His muscles tensed, begging to run, to leap, to fight, and tear anything and anywhere Darren would let them. The agent harnessed a fear that would sprint 1,000 miles, a fear that would help him fight anyone. Darren successfully captured the fear of death that he had placed into his victim by subtly taunting the Queensman at the moment of his demise. Then euphoria struck the agent like a falling star, and Darren toppled over backward with pleasure. He felt his bones uncreak, his skin unwrinkle, and his mind sharpen beyond all previous measure. Darren was suddenly aware more than ever before, and it was intoxicating. However, there came a point when even Darren, drunken with his new youth, knew that he should stop. So he ceased taking, and let the remainder of the Queensman's life flow from his body into the air around them like smoke. When Darren looked back down at his victim, the man was a desiccated corpse. Darren knew, on the other hand, that he would be a smooth, powerful man recently out of his teens. The agent could feel his muscles ripple underneath his skin, charged with the power of the Queensman's last moments. Darren had done this so many times before, and yet the fear of the Queensman was the most charged, the most sustaining. Darren knew that he could use it to escape. His plan was simple, really. Jonathan may have hated Darren, but even Jonathan would grow old one day. Darren would see Cog again, and she would always be young. And no Queensman would ever be able to stop that. Cog hadn't gone back to the palace, and she wasn't sure how she was ever supposed to return after what had happened between Jonathan and her. She wound through the streets of snowy Cerseval, wandering past glowing shop windows that flickered with warm light. As the sun fell down, staining the sky orange and purple like wet watercolors bleeding into one another, Cog thought of how distant she was from anything she could call home. The faces of the Cercevillians were hard to read, their gull features buried beneath layers of winter clothing and scarves, but they all stared at her. Cog's slender, wan neck was exposed to the wind, and her winter clothes were not high fashion, they were utilitarian. The townsfolk focused a lot of their attention on Cog's lower half. She wore a pair of men's work pants and a comfortable pair of woodsman's boots. There were almost certainly no shops in the palace district that sold those sorts of things to women. Those items were reserved for gentlemen explorers headed into the Arctic reaches, not for ladies. Cog had grown tired of all the attention when she noticed something very distinctive about the crowd. Several new faces in the crowd that walked the sidewalk behind her seemed conspicuously disinterested in her appearance. Every time she looked back over her shoulder, she found that 5 or 6 of the pedestrians did not make eye contact, but suddenly inspected the shop windows. At first, their actions weren't suspicious because they were so far behind her on the street. However, as the group of men gained ground on Cog, she realized that they had never once been looking at her when she turned around. Cog found a blind alley and walked straight into it. The men gave chase. She called her sword into her hand as soon as she was out of sight of the main road and dashed down another offshoot from the first alley. The gauzy grip of her glittering blade comforted her heart, and she traced a glyph as she ran. Hissing sparks flew off of the blade, dying in the snowdrifts of the alley cobblestones alongside Cog's footprints. The strangers behind her shouted something at her, but she didn't dare stop to listen until she found the perfect spot. Cog burst from her alley onto 10th Avenue, the crowded street that ran from the palace down to the harbor, with a chorus of surprised shouts from the pedestrians nearby. The alarmed voices of the bystanders increased when they saw the arcing blade in her hand, but Cog didn't care. She plowed past them, into traffic, and hurtled over a speeding milk truck with a heavy bound. Dodging a roadster, Cog launched herself onto the far sidewalk and stopped at the alleyway adjacent to the road to observe the progress of her pursuers. The men across the road were definitely not Queensmen, she guessed, since they blundered into the crowd of gawking pedestrians across the way and actually seemed hampered by the process. The gentlemen did mean business, however, because they all drew revolvers and took aim at the oncoming cars. with a crash of metal and the terrified screams of the people on the sidewalks as they ducked for cover. Traffic on the busy avenue stumbled to a halt.
"Go, get her!"
Cog heard one of them shout, and she didn't wait to see the reaction from the others. The red-haired fighter sprinted down the next alley, her feet spraying snow and leaving bold tracks for the attacking force to follow. She briefly wondered if any man had considered that she wanted them to know her location. She wanted them to tail her until she found a suitable place to fight. Another two turns brought her to the end of her run, a narrow walkway that ran between two four-story brick buildings. At the end of the walkway was a locked door, attached to a section of the four-story buildings that ran all the way to the top.
"That's a dead end, Miss Antonello," panted the first man around the corner as he pointed his pistol at her chest. "Now let's just stop running and surrender, okay?"
Cog turned to face the man at the front of the alley and smiled.
"All right, I accept your surrender, Special Agent
Brinks," said the man. Brinks's friends soon appeared behind him, and he inched forward down the narrow corridor, his steady aim at Cog's pendant.
"Very funny, Miss Antonello. Now I'm going to come over there and remove that pendant from your person, and you're going to drop your sword in the meantime."
"Mr. Brinks, I'm afraid I won't be doing that. You're not going to shoot me,"
she said.
"Oh, but I can and will. I never miss, Miss Antonello. Magic, you know."
"Special Agent Brinks,"
said Cog, noting that there were now six hostile men in the alley making their way toward her.
"This is a sword. If we engage, at least one of you is going to die."
"If you even attempt to lift your sword, I'll put a bullet through that stone and that'll be it for you," said Brinks. "Let's not go down that road."
Cog made no effort to move, but she didn't drop her sword either. Tiny nodes of light sloughed off the shining black iron of her blade like snowflakes.
"The ensuing blast would kill us all, Special Agent."
Special Agent Brinks was so close to striking distance, but just out of reach. If Cog dropped her sword, there would be no chance of retrieving it in time to attack the man, even magically. If he got a hand around her pendant, he could probably get it free without much trouble. Brinks clearly understood her reach, and remained safely outside of one of Cog's arm lengths. Behind him, the other men muscled forward through the alleyway, ready to seize her the moment her lifeless body touched the ground. It galled Cog to think of these men taking her unconscious body back to the main house.
"Listen here, Special Agent,"
Cog began.
"No, Miss Antonello, you listen. I've had enough of this. I'm going to give you to the count of three to drop that sword, or I'm going to put a bullet through you."
Cog had led the men into the alley, but she hadn't counted on them having a spell to stop them from missing with their firearms. Likely it wouldn't even matter if Cog were to try to leap to the nearest window. She would still be shot down by Special Agent Brinks and his men before she could even blink. "One," said Brinks, but he never made it to two. A sound like the popping of firecrackers splattered the far end of the alley, and several shouts of terror and pain erupted from the back of Brinks's assault force. Without thinking, Brinks turned his attention to the new threat. Cog didn't wait. Her front foot swept out with a spray of snow as her sword sliced toward Brinks. When Brinks first looked away from Cog, she had simply been standing there, armed but non-threatening. When his gaze came back to her, Brinks found that his gun hand was missing, instead replaced with a gout of blood. His voice caught in his throat, but eventually managed to squeeze through his neck, first in the form of a low wail, steadily escalating to a howl of fear. He stumbled back, clutching his bleeding stump.
"Everyone get down and no one has to die,"
screamed Cog, but it didn't matter. There was something on the other side of the alleyway, putting shots into the assault force with merciless precision, and no one could hear her. As Cog attempted to identify her unknown benefactor, she almost missed a furious Special Agent Brinks, drawing a heavy throwing knife from within his jacket with his remaining hand. Cog didn't know if the magic he'd mentioned before was still active, and she didn't bother finding out. Cog hurled her sword into the Special Agent's gut like a lightning bolt, sending him flying backward towards his friends. Before he even landed, she called her sword back to her side, leaving the dead man to roll away without it. Brinks's body stopped next to the last man standing from his team. as the remaining seeker looked down to see what had become of his leader. A bullet drilled through his skull. Cog was shocked by what she saw behind the fallen seeker. A pallid old man with chiseled features and a tattered gray duster. The strangest part was not the man's presence as her defender, but rather what he held in his hands. In his right hand, the man held a large caliber handgun, still bristling with smoke and heat from his murderous rampage. In his left, however, he held his own severed head by the hair. Cog knew then that it was the man she had decapitated in the tunnels beneath the main house.
"It would seem you have me at a disadvantage,"
called Cog.
"Indeed," said the man. "If I was in a killing mood, you'd be dead."
Cog did not point out the fact that the man had just killed 5 people to her 1.
"My name is Cog,"
she said.
"Call me Crust."
"I hope that I'm pleased to meet you, Crust,"
said Cog, cautiously stepping over the bodies to get closer to the newcomer.
"What do you want with me?"
"I'm here to help you and your friends. My partners are already inside the main house, and they sent me to get you too."
"I'm glad to see there are no hard feelings, Mr. Crust,"
said Cog, gesturing to her neck. Crust harumphed and turned to walk away from the scene of carnage.
"I'll get better."
"Why did my friends send you to find me, sir?"
Crust half turned, and one of his eyes snapped onto Cog's like a magnet. His lips twisted and pulled across his lower teeth, and Crust snorted.
"Your friends sent me to help you. Was that serious, lady?"
"Oh?"
"Yeah, they've been declared traitors, your friends. Seekers are gonna round them up and kill them all. You wanna quit talking and follow me, Cog?"
said Crust as he turned a corner and stepped in front of a manhole cover. He stuck his gnarled fingers into the holes around the object and lifted it from its receiver, exposing the sewers of Cercival. Cog's grip tightened on her sword.
"Lead on, dear Crust."
Even though Isabel is awake and attacking, will she be able to help Jonathan? Now that Darren has bested the Queensman, will he escape? Can Cog make it back to the palace in time to help her friends? Find out next time on The Gearheart.
This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Today's podcast has been brought to you by Wallaby, Buskerton, and Crust, professional rogues and scallywags. Got a man needs killing, but the normal means just won't do? Call Wallaby, Buskerton, and Crust and put your manslaying mind at ease. Ask for the Spider Special and receive an extra discount. These gentlemen also take payment in the form of cash, check, or human corpse. Wallaby, Buskerton, and Crust, for when you've got the lust for murder. And by Spratt's self-tightening corsets for the lady on the go. Do you tire of tightening your own corset every morning before you go out to face the world? Why not get a Spratt self-tightening corset and fire that lazy help of yours? Each of our corsets comes equipped with a shipyard winch capable of lifting 400 pounds in response to your voice. Simply say stop in a loud, commanding voice and the device will cease. Spratt's self-tightening corsets, for when you have to hide your fat, think Spratt's. We now return you to the Extraordinary Contraptions with the song Fine, from their debut album, Inappropriate on Purpose.